Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Howard Axelrod was in a small cabin in Vermont when thousands of protesters descended on the WTO meeting in Seattle. He was there without a cell phone, computer, or television for the bombing of the USS Cole, the Y2K panic, and the Supreme Court's Bush v. Gore decision. Howard went into the woods not to live deliberately, as Thoreau did. He didn't need a break from technology or a writing retreat. It was 5 years after a freak accident left him without sight in one eye, a loss that changed his vision of the future and ignited his wanderlust. With a few years of traveling and broken love behind him, Howard needed, he writes, to live without putting on a face for anyone, including myself. The Point of Vanishing is Howard Axelrod's memoir of living in solitude for almost 2 years. And Howard Axelrod, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So you were a junior at Harvard when this accident at a pickup basketball game left you without sight in your right eye. What kind of future were you imagining for yourself back then?
I hadn't wanted to imagine a future too much because the track that I was on led to law school, and that wasn't something that gave me great joy to think about. The accident happened right at the end of my junior year. I was pretty much a straight-A student, and I knew I needed to start to figure out, as my classmates were starting to figure out, where I was headed, what I wanted to do, what was important to me. But the track led to law school. My father's a lawyer. My uncle's a lawyer. My brother was heading towards law school. My cousin's a lawyer. It's basically the family business, and that's where the track was leading.
You got knocked off that track.
I got knocked off that track. So I was playing basketball in a pickup game. I had played high school basketball. I played a lot of basketball as a kid, and it was right before finals, as I said, so I went to play basketball just as a way to relax. The basketball court was a place where I felt very at home, where I felt very much myself, and it was just a freak accident. There was a loose ball. It was a rebound, and a boy's finger went into my eye, and it went in quite deeply. It curved around the eyeball and disconnected the optic nerve, which is the cable that runs from the back of the eye to the brain. So with that connection severed, I was blind in my right eye.
Well, the loss of the sight and of depth perception as well, your other senses begin to compensate. You build up what you call your spidey senses. How? What are some of those ways that other things took over?
That's right, my spidey senses. So after you lose vision in one eye or vision in both eyes, studies have shown that I think within a week of the loss of vision, your brain starts to adapt and it starts to take information from the auditory part of your brain and connect those neurons to the visual part of your brain so that you can start to orient not just through what you're seeing or what you are no longer seeing, but through what you're hearing. And the information from what you're hearing goes to the visual part of your brain so that you can start to see in some way what you're hearing. So that happened without my trying to do anything. That was just an adaptation that my brain was doing for me. But I did become aware that my hearing was more acute and that I was orienting in space in part based on what I was hearing. But then there were other ways in which I was trying to adjust consciously. I would walk up to class later because, as you mentioned, I lost some peripheral vision on my right-hand side. So I found I was bumping into people a lot. Also, with the loss of depth perception, it was sometimes hard to know how far away I was from someone or something. So I just tried to give myself more space and to be in places that weren't quite as crowded and to make sure I was seeing as much as possible. So, for instance, I would sit in the back of the class, always all the way on the right, because then I wouldn't have to worry about peripheral vision on the right-hand side, and I would have the whole room in front of me.
Well, you gave yourself a lot of space by going from that environment to a couple of road trips across the country, some time spent in Italy and Bologna. And that led you to this one-year rental in a cabin in Vermont's Northeast Kingdom. And once there, your sensual experience of the world changes dramatically. You know, you write about being attuned to the wind on your face, how your voice sounded craggy and strange without use. And you observe that in the woods, there is no sound that wasn't useful. Were you looking for silence?
Yes, I think what I was looking for most was a kind of compensation or alternative for the depth perception that I lost. So with the loss of vision in one eye, it becomes hard to perceive depth. We perceive depth based on the information going into one eye, and then the brain triangulates that information with the information going in the other eye, so we know where objects are located in space. But so without vision in both eyes, I lost that. And by being in the woods, as we were talking about before, I could focus more on my hearing. So that's another way to orient in space, not just spatially, but also with the benefits of everything that I could hear. But then another way that I think I was looking for was to be someplace where I was aware of time, because that's another kind of dimensionality, not just spatial, but temporal. And by being in the woods, I could see the stars every night, at least when it wasn't cloudy, and I was aware of the mountains. And so I became more aware of the capital T type time, not clock time, but geological time, astronomical time. And having that kind of awareness, it was another version of, I guess, sitting as far back in the classroom as I could, sort of like sitting as far back in life as you can to have the deepest or the widest kind of perspective possible. So it's not so much that I was looking for silence per se. I was just looking for a way to reorient myself through my senses and to use all of my senses to help give myself another kind of depth as a replacement for the kind of depth perception that I'd lost.
Well, it's interesting because there seems to be this kind of conflicted self of being visible or being invisible. You know, here you are in this cabin at the end of a dead-end road, you know, way out in the woods. You have contact with very few people, Nat, your plow guy. There's a woman and her very attractive teenage daughter who run a restaurant in town. Even those people, you kind of want to reach out to, but something keeps you from it. What?
Well, I think that divide between visible and invisible corresponds with a divide that I felt acutely after the accident, which was a divide between my inner life and my outer life. After the accident, once all the blood dissipated and the swelling went away, my right eye actually looked the same as my left for quite a while. So outwardly, I looked the same. I told my friends about the accident, but a lot of people didn't know. But meanwhile, the world looked different to me. Depth perception was gone and peripheral vision had changed. So outwardly, I could maintain that track that I'd been on, the all-around student who was on his way maybe to law school. But meanwhile, inwardly, all the questions about the nature of reality and what I could trust and who I was and who I was going to become only became more immediate and more urgent. So by being in the woods, it was a way of letting go of that outward part of myself, of not having to fulfill any roles for anybody else, not having to put on any masks, and letting go of all the parts of my identity that came from fulfilling those roles. And the question was, if I dropped all of those roles that I played for other people, what would be there? And that, of course, tends towards the invisible. But it's not that I wanted to be invisible. I just wanted to try to get to the more interior part of myself and live from there, orient from there.
We're speaking with Howard Axelrod. He is the author of the new memoir, The Point of Vanishing. It's about living in solitude in Vermont's Northeast Kingdom for almost 2 years. Now, this was following an accident when he lost sight in one eye. So I guess he was looking for an orientation that he could trust the natural world. You know, your family doesn't know quite what to think. Somebody, maybe it was your cousin or your brother, calls you the Unabomber when you resurface at a family Thanksgiving. They compare you to Chris McCandless of that Into the Wild, that book, fame. I couldn't help thinking of that movie, Vanishing Point. But even if you don't know that, there is this kind of, you know, vision of American maleness as the loner who doesn't need or want anybody else or who's escaping something. And I wonder how you see your years of solitude in comparison with this kind of untouchable male who needs nobody else.
I think in some ways I was following in that tradition, I suppose. It's not as though I fashioned myself after Thoreau, who in fact spent a lot of time with other people and apparently was going to his mom's back window to get peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and who was really hardly a hermit. But that is a part of the American tradition, or at least the American mythos. And I was a strange combination in that I was very confident still but I was also very lost. And so I had this sense that I could figure out the answers for myself. I also had the sense that at first that heading west, which is so American, heading west into big open spaces would help me find those answers. And then ultimately retreating into the woods and into solitude would help me. And that impulse may be less American than, say, Eastern. You can find parallels in a lot of different cultures where there's retreat to solitude, to silence. I did a reading the other night at this nature center in Connecticut, and there was a sign on the wall. It was an owl. And it says there was a wise owl who lived in an oak. The more he saw, the less he spoke. The less he spoke, the more he heard. Why can't we be like that wise old bird? So, I mean, I don't know if that's the owl tradition or what, but I certainly appreciated that idea of the more he saw, the less he spoke. And then also the less he spoke, the more he heard. You know, what that is when we decide to try to turn down the noise of daily life and get away from it, escape from it, certainly, but also use it as a way of searching to hear something else, something deeper inside of ourselves, but then also in the natural world. And then from there, ideally, to have a way to return. So there's an ability to hear more, to pay attention better with other people.
You did have a couple of forays back into the socialized world, one on Thanksgiving in a New York town. You almost got arrested. I'm going to leave that to readers to find out. But also, you went to Cambridge, your old stomping grounds, and you felt like a wild animal who'd wandered into a zoo. So why did you decide to go back to the city?
So those first forays back were extremely difficult. I was ill-prepared. To go back to our friend Thoreau, he said that all his time in solitude or quasi-solitude made him more eager for company but less fit for it. Hmm. And that's certainly what happened with me. I felt as though, oh, now I've learned to be more attentive and to listen in a different way and to be so appreciative of another person's existence, the way you might wonder at a deer or a bird if you hadn't seen any movement for quite a while. But then I came back into the city and was just overwhelmed, felt bombarded by sirens and taxi breaks. And so that didn't work out too well. And as a preview, it made me think maybe I shouldn't come back at all. But as I spent more time in the woods and that second winter grew deeper and deeper, I felt myself being pulled towards that sense of losing the self, towards being more like the wind and the snow. And ultimately that becomes dangerous. I mean, it may sound pleasant if you're studying Zen, but certainly if you're a psychologist or a psychiatrist, it's a warning sign. And for me, I didn't recognize the warning signs for a while, and then eventually it became clear. I had a dream one night that I had killed someone, and I didn't know who I had killed, and I didn't know where the body was, but I needed to hide the body. And I was in my high school where I went as a kid, and eventually, I found the body stashed in a locker. And of course, when I opened the locker door, the body was mine. The face was mine. And and the dream was terrifying. I mean, it was to recognize, it couldn't have been more obvious. I guess maybe my subconscious was saying, listen, we're going to make it really clear for you. We don't want you to miss this one. Pay attention. This is getting dangerous. And indeed, it was. I mean, I'm a pretty slender guy, and I weigh 155 pounds now, and when I came out of the woods, I was 120. Mm. I mean, I just hadn't been eating very well, and I was, in a lot of ways, tending towards non-existence. So ultimately, there was a realization that if I were to keep living that way, that was going to become my life. I was going to lose, even if I didn't die, just by living in the woods like that, I was going to lose my connections to my friends and to my family and to my past.
Well, Howard, I know that when we were arranging for you to come to the studio and talk to us today, we were told that you don't have a cell phone. I wonder how you're getting on in this, you know, you live in an urban area, you live in the Boston area, you don't have a cell phone. How do you connect with all your friends for those beautiful occasions?
So I do have a landline, and my friends are welcome to call me on my landline. The ringer is off and off when I'm writing, but they're welcome to leave a voicemail message. And I never did have a cell phone, but I don't feel any impulse towards having a cell phone. Just driving here, actually, to come to the studio, I got a little lost And I suppose if I had a GPS, that would have helped. But so I pulled into a gas station, and there was a man out front working on a car. And I said, listen, I have to be at the studio in 10 minutes. Can you help me? And he told me where to go, and he smiled at me, and I got here. You know, so there are other ways of getting around, or even if you get lost, finding your way. And I don't know, Facebook, Tinder, I'm not really curious to see what's happening by the minute. I think that if we take more time with our experiences and we're more present wherever we are, then when we actually meet up with other people or have phone conversations with other people, we'll have a lot more to offer rather than just, here's a snapshot of the sangria I had last night at the Mexican restaurant. I don't know why that would really be interesting to anyone to share or to hear about. So I think it's okay. Friends sometimes get annoyed if they're late to meet me and they wanted to tell me they were late and that I didn't have a phone, but I don't mind waiting. So then I just tell them it's fine. If you're 15 minutes late, I don't care.
Oh, Howard Axelrod, thank you for finding your way to the studio and speaking with us today.
Sure. Thank you.
Howard Axelrod, he teaches at Grub Street, and he's the author of The Point of Vanishing, a memoir of 2 years in solitude. There's much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org.